We are affected profoundly by the things around us, be that objects or be it the spaces we, you know, work and play in and live in, and the places where we sort of inhabit both mentally and physically.
Well, hello and welcome everybody to another episode of Partners in Time, the podcast where we talk to extraordinary personalities around the world of watchmaking, of form, a timekeeping and aesthetics, to really get to the bottom of what makes them tick and what brings our two areas together. And today I'm joined by my dear friend and a very special guest, Hani Rashid, a Brooklyn-based architect, lecturer, mentor to many people, including my sort of aesthetic style guide through the years, I'd say. Hani, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. How are you doing?
Chris, fantastic. And it's a pleasure, great pleasure for me to be here. And thank you for that. I didn't know that you were using your aesthetic compass always according to my mentorship, but that's nice to hear.
Definitely. I mean, I don't think I've met many people in my lifetime who are as profoundly insightful when it comes to all things to do with form, aesthetics, and that wider context. And I must say, you know, it's very easy to fall with you into very deep and meaningful conversations very quickly. So trying to keep it lighthearted as much as possible. But I mean, you are quite somebody in the world of architecture and design. You've designed many things beyond spaces, towns, cities, and buildings. But maybe for our listeners, give us a little bit of an insight into who you are, your story, and what connects you to the world of timing and architecture, really.
Yeah, well, I'm Egyptian born, but born to a British mother and an Egyptian father, and had left Egypt when I was very young, and grew up in Europe, and then eventually Canada, and had moved my practice here to the United States, where I'm now living and working in New York City. I've been involved in architecture my entire life, but in fact, I'd sort of come to architecture from a passion for filmmaking and photography and storytelling even, and has somehow transitioned into this world of making spaces and things. And we do a wide variety of work from, as you said, city planning and large-scale building projects down to very scale-wise smaller, but maybe even very profound things and objects, and also venture a great deal into the art world, producing installation pieces and objects and other things. So really just kind of navigating the world of spatiality, aesthetics, and ideas is just my passion. And that's what I do from 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I guess.
Definitely. And that's sort of the difference, you know, with me sort of hobby architect turned a watch CEO to a proper designer and architect.
Yeah.
That you nonchalantly, when we panic about a corner in a shop, you just, you know, city planning, you know, countries, islands, the like. You know, this is something, and maybe that's, I'm not sure if that's the right question to start with, but I often wonder, because this whole thing of urban master planning and urban planning, you know, it is where sort of architecture enters this different dimension of actually defining people's lives at the end of the day in interaction with space. Because the cities and the urban landscapes we live in, they really define a lot how we look at our environment, how we experience our environment, how we go about our day-to-day business. It seems to me a much more, not just intellectual, but also much more sort of philosophical exercise than the concrete task of please design a house. How do you approach something like that when somebody comes to you with sort of a master planning exercise?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of double side to that. On the one hand, all design problems are sort of interrelated in my mind. And so the scale is really just a matter of shifting the needle, let's say, according to extremely large scale to extremely small scale. But on the other hand, I have a deep belief and a very strong thinking about cities and spatiality that they speak to the dignity of the human condition. There's an old axiom coming out of a Vitruvius in the 16th century, who wrote in a book, in a very important book for architects, beautiful cities make for beautiful people. And the reverse is true, of course. And what that means is that we are affected profoundly by the things around us, be that objects or be it the spaces we, you know, work and play in and live in, and the places where we sort of inhabit both mentally and physically. So there's an incredible correlation there between things that are well designed, thought about deeply, engineered and artistically created at a very high level, that have a profound impact on our psyches, on our way of being. And so, you know, when I approach a city plan or a city design, I think, first of all, in the modality of what is good design, what is intelligent design, considered sort of, you know, proper. And on the other hand, I'll switch gears and say, well, what is really the metaphysical side of the equation? What makes for something to be profoundly important, to be loved and to be sort of adored? You could even use those words in design, of course, and you can use it in space and in city design. So, it's a journey I love taking. And I think what I like about drawing and designing and thinking about large scale projects like cities or large plans or master plans, alongside, of course, all the other things we do, is the ability to sort of oscillate back and forth between those two very different, but at the same time interrelated, sort of philosophical positions on design. It's just a very interesting journey, and you really find yourself also intellectually in a fantastic sort of bouncing back and forth between, you know, to your point, you know, a corner that's working remarkably well versus a circulation system in a city versus how you bring health and well-being to people, how you create aesthetic joy, how you create places for people to live their lives, which is a very, very profound design problem.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it's something that many of us don't really think about, I think, when we just look at design urban environments and the places we live and work. We often underappreciate that. And I think it struck me very much when one of my first units at university in interior design was actually environmental psychology. And in the beginning, you think, what, environmental psychology? Well, that's going to... But then you realize that actually this entire thing of where we feel safe and well and not stressed, what's happening to our sort of fight and flight instincts when we move around spaces, when we sit down somewhere, why we feel comfortable and nestled and secure in one place and not in another, what's good atmosphere and all of that, it has a huge impact on how we feel. And I think once you study that a bit, you realize that in environments all around us, how massive that actually is. And I often think that there are so many badly designed spaces that we use all of the times, from, you know, courtrooms to hospitals to, you know, airports, train stations, you know, and they are designed or not designed in a way that they cause an awful lot of stress. And I think you can see it immediately in people's behavior and aggression levels. And we all know that when you're, you know, in a very stressful multi-suitcase train to check-in situation, you know, with four kids in tow, everyone's been there, and your aggression level and your behavior immediately changes because you are going and transiting through a very stressful environment. And I think you have a fantastic potential as an architect to find intelligent solutions to that. And it's something that, in two little examples, that is often approached completely the wrong way around. And I know that from, you know, when I used to live in the UK there, and he had these like terrible doctor surgeries that totally overcrowded, and same in the tube system. And then the response is always that more and more posters and warning notices go up in these spaces saying, do not attack staff, zero tolerance. If you have a headbutt, the receptionist will lock you up. But they're not looking at the actual problem. They're just fighting the symptoms of the space. And in the same way, I remember the security system at Geneva Airport for years and years and years had a system of trays that was completely different from anywhere else in the world, where basically you grabbed a tray right at the beginning of a very long meandering queue And they depended on you basically taking that tray, putting your stuff in and keep pushing that tray forward, which nobody understood and always ended up in endless delays. And they first responded to that for years by just putting bigger and bigger posters up saying, move your bloody tray forward. Until one day somebody realized that the system didn't make sense. They redesigned it to a normal airport system. And since then, hey ho, it works. You know, so, you know, design has a massive impact on.
Well, we're seeing it. We're seeing it everywhere. I mean, we're seeing it now in urban space. We're seeing things where you have benches, be they in airports or in the public realm, where there's big X's or stickers where people shouldn't sit too close together by virtue of the pandemic. So you see all of this kind of misguided adjustments and tweaking of bad design to try and remedy the situation, as opposed to getting to the root of the problem, which has to do with what we just discussed. You know, it's interesting because I was just thinking as you were saying that. You know, I had a discussion with a very close friend of mine who's a pretty high end scientist and one of the most brilliant people I know in the realm of science and invention. But it occurred to me in our conversation that I accused my friend of saying, well, you know, the problem with your world is you forget what it is. You're not looking at it from the humanist point of view, humanist traditions, humanist history, and so on. And he said to me, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you know, we live in a world which is quote unquote engineered. We rely on science for everything. We rely on science to get us from one place to the other, that our cars work, our bridges work, our roads work. Technology is a giant driver in our world. Look at us now on this, talking to each other in this podcast. It's all about technology, but we forget, because we're overwhelmed and seduced by technology, that there's a flip side to all of that, which is the human condition. And if you start to really think about that, it's you know, we're not living in a world where everything is driven by that, or else we'd be living in a very strange world. But at the same time, it really needs to be in play to offset the predominantly technological world we live in. An interesting example in architecture is the rise of behavioral science in the 70s. Where it became a driver for architects as a kind of crutch to design better spaces, because science was telling us in that period, that a certain green, for example, is a soothing color in a hospital.
Yeah.
Hospitals should
NATO
be painted.
Army barracks, yes.
Exactly. And that you know, was kind of almost became a sort of an easy solution to a lot of problems was, okay, well, science has the answer then, you know, let's do everything green. And today is, as I know, and there's a big, big discussion in healthcare and healthcare architecture about how wrong we got so much, how many things we got wrong by virtue of listening to behavioral science sort of vectors, as opposed to going back and looking at it from other points of view. And just one of the antidotes, to that is nature. We've discovered, you know, with science and without science, that the importance of nature in terms of our lives, in terms of being human beings, is of paramount importance to our well-being. You know, even just standing in a forest, they've proven makes you feel elevated emotionally. So how do we bring, one of our big questions these days in architecture is, how do we bring some of those otherwise ineffable and difficult to pinpoint aspects that appeal to the human condition at a very deep level into the way we design space and architecture. And it's become an interesting problem. And then you find yourself back in the question of lighting, technological invention, artificial intelligence, even machine learning. We're touching on all these subjects, but not to solve problems, but rather to inject into the otherwise scientific and technologically driven discipline the sense of the human and what it means to be human.
Yeah, and I totally agree though also. I mean, we've seen so many examples that lighting is another one of those factors that makes a massive difference that is constantly under-considered and underappreciated. I remember very clearly, I think it was like some point in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the German rail system introduced the first ICE high-speed trains in those days, wide-body trains that were, you know, quite low floor design. It was really quite something different. Obviously looked like a bullet train, sort of following the example of the Shinkansen in Japan. But what they did from the beginning is they designed a space that I think was supposed to be luxurious. That's probably how they got there in the beginning. But that actually worked with very much sort of indirect, warm, and quite dim lighting. Mm-hmm. Versus what you normally have in trains for sort of public safety and security kind of aspects, which is always like, okay, let's stick a fluorescent tube in, make it 3,000 lux cold abattoir lighting throughout. And it's just not relaxing people, right? Whereas if you have a comfortable chair and you have low angle lighting and, you know, it's not too noisy in there and you've got your in-flight entertainment system, and you could see people, they step onto these trains and they kind of sat down and went, ah.
Yeah.
And everybody was kind of a little bit hushed and sort of gentle with each other. And you don't have this. And then you have the London commuter train, you know, crammed onto this like 3,000 lux, rattling, noisy, drafty kind of train experience. And everybody wants to like literally punch each other in the face. And it is amazing how much difference that can make.
Yeah.
But, you know, tell us a little bit. I mean, how did you come to set up Asymptote in New York? I mean, talking about stressful urban environments, you moved from Ontario to the place where every lorry driver shouts. No. How did that happen?
Well, actually, it was sort of an interesting road. I finished my undergrad education in Canada. Then I moved to Milan. Then I did an undergraduate school in Michigan here in the States. And then I moved to Milan and started my practice. So I was 2 years in Milan, struggling with urban chaos. Yes, absolutely. Also struggling with a situation there, which was driven by two factors. One was it was impossible to get a phone line relatively young. You know, I was very young, but I was trying to set up a practice, and it was very difficult to work through the Italian bureaucracy. And the other was that I discovered that there's a kind of a, at that time especially, it was a kind of a closed system of Milanese, you know, architects and designers who were using a lot of stranieri, as they called us, strangers from abroad, to design work. But when it came to setting up my own practice, then all the sharks came out of the water. And I was in this very interesting place and milieu, you know, dealing with all of these people who were telling me that I'm not Milanese, I shouldn't be here, blah, blah, blah. So I met a man named Pierre Rastini. It was a fantastic art critic for Domus at the time. And he looked at my portfolio and said, this work is fascinating, but you need to get out of here now. he says, you need to either move to Paris or New York, because those are the only two places where you're going to be able to practice and do the kind of work you want to do. And I took his advice. And it turned out at the same time, my partner, Lisanne Couture, was just finishing at Yale. And she wanted very much to live in New York also and hated Milan, actually, at the time. For many of those same reasons. And so we decided to come together here to New York and start a practice, start Asymptote. You know, and we chose, actually, just as a side note, we chose a name.
Asymptote.
Well, we chose it. It was an interesting story because I was looking desperately for some kind of a name for a practice and a studio that would be, you know, that would indicate what we're trying to do both in the art world, the technology world, and the architecture world at the same time. And I read this fantastic Baudelaire novel who had said that the women of Paris are like asymptotes. And I thought, okay, that's very interesting. Is that sexist or is that poetic? And as I looked more into it, I realized that there was a kind of profound philosophical tradition around the notion of the asymptote, which is, for any of the audience listening, is basically, who don't know, it's probably everyone does know, but is a mathematical term of the convergence of two lines, a hyperbolic curve and a straight line, at infinity, which sounds like a non sequitur because the two converging lines never actually meet. They continue to get closer and closer together, but they don't actually touch. And I thought that was a very beautiful and profound word. That is both mathematical and scientific and extremely important in math and in physics, but at the same time, very, very philosophical and you know, yeah, profound. And so we chose the name. And then, of course, I remember thinking, well, wait a minute, I just read a story about a man named Mr. Eastman, who had got his guys together in Rochester, New York, many years ago, and got a group of marketing people together and said, I need a name for a company that means nothing, but can be pronounced in every language. And they said, well, what about Kodak? And that became the brand. And I thought, well, okay, well, this is typical of my radical thinking in that period. I said, I want to meet a word that nobody can pronounce in any language and means everything.
Yeah. I was going to say. And from that day forward, you had fun spelling your email address over the phone to people.
And especially working in other countries all over the world. I mean, the pronunciations I put up with on that word and the inability to pronounce it has been fantastic. But, you know, it's stuck and it's still with us, and it means a great deal to me. And it means a great deal to me also because Lisanne and I are, a man and a woman working on a practice together, who in fact share every aspect of the practice. But at the same time, there's a kind of and I don't want to sound too dramatic here, too poetic or romantic, but the idea of the asymptote being something that converges at infinity and never actually touches.
It's a bit disappointing in a marriage, isn't it?
No. It's the contrary. It's about infinite desire, and that is a very interesting notion, both in terms of relationships, of course, for all of us to have that constantly being there, but also in the work. I mean, for me, the idea, and you asked at the beginning about all the different work that we do, from design to cities to objects to art. I am very much always in the asymptotic trajectory of working towards these ends. But the idea of actually anything closing is something I dread. And so that's where the term is kind of profound.
Yeah, absolutely. And it talks a little bit about being on a kind of eternal journey, in a sense. And by the way, we made it almost to 20 minutes without going totally deep and meaningful. But here we are.
Sorry.
Pass the red wine. No, but it's true because, you know, and that's something that I always identify with IWC quite a bit. It's about this journey that, you know, where, I mean, we have this tagline, of course, the journey is your destination. But there's a lot of truth in that because, you know, this idea of finishing something for good is, to me, a very daunting one, you know, because that moment I'm going to be terribly bored when you've literally can sort of, you know, sit up and sit back and go, I've done it. Here we are. Job done. Goodbye. Then that's quite a scary thought. And I think, as you say, I think we strive for this idea of perfection that we have in our mind somewhere. Whenever we look back at anything we do, we say, okay, maybe that was a 7 or an 8. And then we know we can do it better next time, want to do it better next
well,
time.
Well, I mean, the very joy in life, the very power and profundity of life is the constant search and the constant, you know, and always having desire. And that's really what drives all of us, to be... whatever we do in life or however we live our lives, but I think it's this idea of constantly a search. Some people take it to a very dramatic level. I mean, explorers and others of us, find it in creative work. Some find it in business. I mean, but it's for all of us extremely important. And closing it down is something I think we all, and I hate to use the word, but I will say it, existentially dread.
Yeah.
So maybe that's really key, and it makes for a kind of wonderful journey. That's what life is.
Absolutely. Now, one of those, I mean, the project that where sort of I first came across your work, sort of very physically, literally, indirectly, is of course your Yas Hotel in Yas Marina in Abu Dhabi, because that was literally the place where. Once us starting with Formula One, me attending the first Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, but probably back in 2017, I think. And I was immediately struck by the presence, and I think I said this to you many times, but it's not just the sculptural form and the presence of that building on Yas Island, but it's also the degree to which this creates a sense of place in this otherwise sort of newly developed bit of Abu Dhabi. And Abu Dhabi, obviously, for, you know, most of you will know, but it sits across many different islands, so it's kind of difficult at times to figure out, you know, what center and point of convergence means in a place like that, that is sort of interconnected by thousands of roads and, you know, a bit of residential and office bits and so on. But this entire Yas development is really beautifully, beautifully anchored by that Yas Hotel. So talk to us a little bit about what sort of went into creating that particular execution, that project.
Yeah, I mean, it was in a way kind of a labor of love when it started, because I was so happy let me backtrack. We got a call one day. We were doing a tower called the Strata Tower in Abu Dhabi, and we got a call and said, you know, I forget which sheikh it is, but one of the sheikhs had looked at the proposals for the Yas circuit, And was very unhappy with the hotel design or whatever, because he wanted it to be a kind of a sort of an important global presence as a building, and the Formula One coming landmark, to Abu Dhabi, yeah, landmark, and the Formula One coming to Abu Dhabi was very, very important to the Emirati and to these people. So could we have something more interesting? And I, the story goes that I got the call. It was sort of, so he walked in the room. He said, "I don't want this project. Find me an architect now. You have 5 days," and left the room. At which point we get this frantic call, and they said to us, "You know, we're going to run a competition. We've picked five of you around the world. You have 5 days to produce an idea for, you know, that could be important and it could work." So we immediately sat down and said, "Okay, well, you know, the amazing thing about this project at that time was the fact that we had a tabula rasa to work with. I mean, it was essentially Yaz at that point. Yaz Island was a desert and land reclamation in the water. We had a Formula One circuit that was already designed, of course, and beginning to be implemented. And we said, okay, so what do we do? Number one, we said, you know, we should really dredge and create a marina. So we should somehow fuse, yacht culture and marina culture with racing culture. So we designed that. And then the second thing was the experimentation. And this is where I was saying earlier about kind of jumping from science to art. We said, okay, the first move we made, the first sketches we made, we poured a kind of virtual liquid mercury. I know this sounds very strange, but we took a program that we were working with at the time, a software program, and developed a liquid mercury viscosity, let's say, and texture. And then poured it over the land and the marina that we were bridging the track, and produced this kind of aerodynamic form, this kind of bulbous form that we developed further and further and further. And said this should be the kind of symbol and the kind of covering for the hotel, and it should bridge over the Formula One track because we wanted to have the cars race literally through the hotel. And see where we go with that. And we pulled that off in a few days in the office. It was sort of 24-hour, 5 days work. And then sent the drawings over and kind of, ducked and took cover to see what would happen. And we got a call 3 days later and said that effectively they looked in the sheikh walked in the room, looked around, pointed at our scheme and said, "Build that and you have exactly 24 months. And that's when the whole thing started to go crazy, because no one had ever built a building of that size and that stature in such a short period of time. And so we pulled out all the stops technologically we could in terms of, what's at the time was very early in BIM modeling, which is a business, building tools, building intelligence management tools. Yeah, it started to work. And so as we were working through this kind of, aerodynamically generated architectural object, we said, but it really has to have, as you just pointed out, a sense of place and a sense of purpose in that region. And so then we started looking at, we looked at the math in Islamic architecture and the kind of tessellation of surfaces and algorithms. We looked at billowing structures that you would find in Bedouin tents. We looked at the social spaces of souks and other things. And we tried to say, could we inject the project with these sort of historic references, but without any sort of cliches, without any sort of, what we coined as Disneyland effect. We wanted to produce something that was completely new and powerful and abstract and not tied necessarily to any one reading, and that's how it went. And that was being done at the same time as we were frantically trying to figure out how to make that whole grid shell with our very, very fantastic engineers in Stuttgart, Schleiberger.
I was going to say, I didn't know that, but I was going to say to you, then that was probably the moment when you phoned a German glass and metal engineer and said, "What kind of problem?"
Well, Schleibergermann is a terrific firm and terrific engineers. We've worked with them quite a bit, and we got on the call with them and said, "Look, we have this idea. We need to build this shell, we need to touch the ground in as few places as possible." I mean, we made as impossible as we could as an engineering feat as we possibly could for them. And off to work they went, and with us. And then there was a kind of a fantastic, I'll never forget, it was a fantastic sort of Apollo 13 moment where we all gathered in Vienna with the construction methodology, with the sort of material engineers, with the modelers, and we together brainstormed the way that this whole building could sort of sit on 7 points actually, and span over 500 meters. Contains 5,682 pieces of glass of different dimensions, ranging from a half a meter to 4 meters.
You sound like you had to clean them before the opening.
And then the cleaning is a fantastic story, because we had a meeting and I was told, to bring scenarios. We brought a bunch of specialists in, and we had an idea to robotically clean all the glass, have robots on every glass. And then someone in the meeting just looked at me and said, no, we're going to use repelling. and that's how it works. There are people
avoidance rather than
exactly.
But so, what is your view on? Because I often wondered that whether, as an architectural designer, being given too much time is generally not a good idea for creativity. what do you think? I mean, is that something you've observed? Because I often think, like, if you're going to have a good idea about something, it's probably going to come quite quickly in some shape or form. And if it doesn't come, it's probably not going to come 6 weeks down the line either. Is time pressure a good thing, or how do you think about that?
Well, there are two things. In graduate school, my professor at the time told me very profoundly that you can have a great idea in 10 minutes and a lifetime to execute it, which I've always subscribed to and I believe. And the second thing is Lisanne, my partner, always says to me that nothing ever happens with me until I'm in a pressure cooker.
And
getting in that pressure cooker and
getting
to that point where there are no more, there's no more doorways
no
out
more
of
excuses.
This thing, no more excuses, no
okay.
more
11 a.m. go,
no more bike races to watch. Yeah,
we'll come on then, to that in a minute.
and then it's really and what's interesting about that, and I developed this while I was in grad school as a kind of set of beliefs. There was a fantastic text that I had read about this idea of informed intuition. And there's a whole sort of, there's a whole set of sort of ideas around that you basically have to find a way to inform the psyche, inform your mentality, inform your sensibilities with as much information as you possibly can. But there's a moment of release when it comes to designing, when it comes to creating, which is then turning off all the knowledge in some ways and working in the intuitive. But the idea is how informed is that intuition? Is that intuition just outright intuition, and therefore you're just floundering around, or is it coming with a great deal of knowledge? And that's also why I think as an architect, it takes us years and years to actually get to the point where we actually are performing correctly. I've always said that almost everything I did from the time I graduated until the last, say, 10 years was kind of just dress rehearsal for the practice that I have now, where we've sort of hitting our stride, because it takes so much of sort of filling up that cup, so to speak, or filling up that reservoir with information to the point where your intuition is actually profound and considered and precise. Yeah. So getting in a situation of being under extreme pressure is kind of building up the sort of the tension on that intuition that's ready to be released. But the whole question is, and I think this is important for all creatives and all of us out there who have to come up with solutions, is trusting at some moment, learning to trust that aspect, and not sort of stopping yourself, mid work or midstream, and saying, "Oh, but I don't know where this is coming from." I think it's the opposite. I'm actually very, very excited when I don't know where something is coming from.
No, absolutely. And I mean, what I love about this building, and I mean, I'm sure many of our listeners will know it well, it's a building that looks fast. It looks dynamic. It looks like it's in motion. It generates emotion that surely makes that together with a turquoisey sort of anti-slip lines around the racetrack.
Well, I'll tell you a fantastic story on that. We worked with a fantastic guy, John Bullo, who was really the client and the kind of who just stood behind us 100% on that project. And I had to show John and some of the local sort of, he was the CEO of Aldar at the time. I had to show him and a few other people how the project looked with the video signals. Because it has five, all those windows have also a 36 million color pixel projector on them. So we can send video streams from New York or from anywhere to the building surface, and it plays them. So we decided to sit in the desert. We went out to the furthest grandstands at the track. And I said to John, okay, it was the night. It was now dark. I said, okay, John, watch this. And I called New York. I said, okay, put the video on. And the video we sent over was the building in a wind tunnel at 280 kilometers an hour. And we projected that onto the building, sat there in the desert and watched the building racing through the desert 280K an hour. And that was a thrilling moment for that project.
amazing. But I relate to that time pressure on that, because it was probably the most aerodynamic thing I've ever designed was actually our engineer wind tunnel booth back in 2013. And it was one of those situations as well. I think it was 8:30 in the morning, and one of my dear bosses, put the gun to my head sort of proverbially and just said, okay, by 11:30, we need to have the design or else. And it was just that, okay, I lock myself in, I have a go. And that worked out. And then you say you have a lifetime to execute. Once you've got the basics in place, you can work on all the details, but sometimes you need that time pressure to actually come up with something that is not too overthought.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I noticed, which I find very particular about this project, and I'm sure others of yours as well, is there's a new generation of architectural renderings that I've really seen emerge in, mainly in the Middle East and in China, which are usually in sort of half-lit, dusky conditions where you see all the lights on and everything's fireworks and, sort of water fountains. And these buildings look incredibly beautifully lit until you actually get there. And it's usually like a dull gray, hazy day. And all you see is steel and green glass and it all looks terribly dull.
Absolutely.
And your building is one of those that actually looks like that in real life. Like when you're actually there and the race is on and the sun goes down as it does in the Middle East quite early on. And suddenly this thing comes to life with the lighting and does actually look exactly like it did in the renderings. And it has got that presence to it. So it's not just sort of rendered to theme park level.
That makes me very happy here, because in fact, that's been the whole quest for us. I mean, I the reason that I work in the art world as well as the architecture world and the design world is not because I'm trying to do multiple careers. It's rather they're all ways to research the thing that I'm the most interested in, which is, creating interesting objects and spatiality. And so the idea of serving or probing the phenomenological or the phenomenology of something is so important to me and to the work that what we do is we've have a pretty interesting track record that almost all the buildings we've built are better in reality than any rendering we produced. And that's become a kind of mantra for me in our practice, that the renderings, of course, are photorealistic and spectacular and seductive, but the phenomenology of something, the way something acts in real space, in real time, against the glint of the sky, against a particular, state of mind even. I mean, there's so many other things that drive the way we see physical space. To get that into a project demands a kind of a hardcore research and development of these other principles of design that are not necessarily quantitative. It goes back to what I was saying before about being humanist. So it's really key. Right now, I'm working on a project in Budapest. This morning, before we came on this, I was looking at with one of my designers. I was looking at the way that we are going to light the building and sort of work the building from day to night and through the transition of twilight and dusk and so on. And we're sitting here looking at, very strange conceptual videos on the screen of tests of hues and variations and sort of, again, phenomenological kind of things that at the end we have to figure out what the technical way of implementing that is. And there's no way to get that in a rendering. At the end of the day, it has to be the actual effect that will take place. We can do renderings that kind of get close to it, but the reality of something, and I think this is something also to speak about, what IWC is, the reality of something carries with it all of that research, all of that history, all of that sort of pedigree and depth that comes out at the end in something is way beyond what you see in a kind of, no matter how high end the rendering is.
Yeah. Well, you just stole my beautiful segue. I was looking forward to that.
Sorry.
No, but it is, you know, and I often spoke about that also because of my background in design, that really in the watch world, it is exactly as you described. There is no amount of rendering and visualization that can give you a realistic impression of a product on the wrist like a mechanical watch. It doesn't work.
Right.
You know, you can look at proportions and angles and materials and colors and stuff, but in our world, every single little light reflection, the feeling on your skin, it makes so much difference. The feel of a material, the feel of the leather, of the metal, of the titanium on your wrist, it makes a massive difference to how you perceive the product. That, yes, we make photography and rendering to plan, and we do it obviously to get people interested and excited about watch designs. But, you know, probably most people who bought a mechanical watch can testify to that the moment you put this thing on your wrist, it is something completely different. And also there's a huge personal component, because either you as a human being connect with that product and you go, oh yeah, I feel at one with it, and I feel right with it, and it works on my wrist, or you think, I absolutely love this watch, but I can't wear it. You know, and there's many watches like that for me where I absolutely love the design, hate them on my wrist. And
yeah,
I think that's maybe, you know, where those two approaches are very, very similar in that sense.
No, there's a really strong correlation between what I was discussing earlier about sort of the antidote to technological, let's say, obsession. Also, on the flip side, the humanist condition. And it's really interesting, the correlation between, let's say, a watch or an object that predominantly exists as a seductive rendering, but has no physical or metaphysical presence in reality when you actually deal with it, because it loses its depth. In other words, you're wearing a rendering, right? Mm-hmm. On some digital watches,
yes, like the AR try-on.
Exactly. And you have the same problem in architecture. You know, your point earlier is extremely important and profound for our discipline, and many, many architects should hear what you said about the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, glitzy renderings that produce relatively banal outcomes, we are living in a kind of rendered world, not in a viscous world of depth and profundity. And the same thing goes with the object. You know, I was thinking earlier before we did this podcast about my interest in IWC and the way that you and I got involved, and why I'm so passionate about IWC and working with you, is that I realized, and I learned this from you, I have to be honest, I learned this from you and from our relationship and our friendship, that In a world where you spend all of your time trusting the here and now, i.e. the digital, i.e. the sort of the Instagrammable, the sort of here and now, the sound bite, and so on and so forth, there's a kind of that the weight of the watch, and I have to say this to me is kind of profound, the weight of the watch is the weight of history and storytelling and engineering and it resonates. You feel like you're actually looking into a much deeper, and I sort of be architectural about it, but it's like looking into a very sort of beautiful tunnel, or into a beautiful spatiality, as opposed to just looking at the surface when I look at it. So no matter how much data is on my wrist, I mean, if I'm wearing a sports watch and I've got like my heartbeat and my oxygen levels and all that stuff, I'm just looking at the surface. I there's no depth there. But when you're wearing something like a timepiece that carries with it, you know, all of this fantastic history, and in the IWC case, back to here, Brooklyn and Boston, and all the way to Schaffhausen, you are looking beyond the time on the screen and beyond the data into the very sort of depth of and the resonance of meaning and history and time, and that's really interesting. And to me, that's also about architecture, because if I'm in a building or producing a new building, my real question in my work is what is this building like? And I know it sounds weird, but you know, what is this building like many decades from now? And architecture is a permanent art. We don't design for the next 5 years or 10 years or according to a fashion sort of trend. We design for the very long haul. And you know, and I've always remembered when I did the my first project with Lisanne, we did Steel Cloud in Los Angeles that we won in a competition back in when we started. And I remember it being asked in a lecture in Mexico you know, will I build this building? Because it was extremely radical and very, very difficult to see built in the time it was designed. And I said, no, you know, maybe my granddaughter will build it. And there was a big, like, a big sort of sigh in the audience. It was this kind of, you know, you could see the audience was like, what? What's he talking about? But the tradition of architects passing down their work through generations to build important, you know, churches or buildings is and has been quite normal. And we tend to forget that. So, yeah, I think there's something really interesting about wearing and being part of a long, powerful and beautiful story that's both technological and artistic at the same time. Which,
as we say in the watch world, not just a pretty face. Indeed. It's absolutely true, because at the end of the day, the creation of the mechanism, it is a document of cultural heritage, of things that have been passed down for generations. And it is that intersection between design, technology, and craftsmanship. And again, that sounds like very obvious, but it's true that with all of the technological capability we have today, we sometimes have to get back to this kind of very archaic way of working that I always imagine. I mean, you just described the architects probably hands-on building churches, cathedrals, mosques, and the likes centuries ago, who would literally sit there on the scaffolding and chisel away at something until the form was right, you know, and there was a crafted, iterative process involved in the whole thing. You didn't just, you know, create something on the computer and hit the 3D print button and off it went. It was a process of actually feeling then from concept in your head to the finished form. I think we all know that from Lego, maybe, in a sense. You know, you start off with a rough idea, but then the process of doing it actually turns it into something that goes much further than probably what you wanted to do in the beginning. And that's exactly sometimes what I find is so hampered nowadays when we work with a lot of library objects in rendering, and the kind of your design becomes, residential design becomes almost dominated by whatever is available on the database, whatever you can download for free. You know, it's like it's a huge limiting factor. And we come to these points all of the time, not only in what I said with in terms of prototyping and computer-aided design on watches, but also the fact that there are certain technical challenges which are very clear from a data science point of view. But then the answer to that is not technological at all. You know, we had it the other day. We were discussing like a tolerance issue on a hairspring. And, you know, there was some ultra precise laser measurement at a supplier that, like, you know, threw up the entire question. And then I said to my colleague, Andy, who's the CEO, he said, so how do we fix this? How do you go about it? And what can we do? And I expected there'd be like some systems answer. And he said, we need basically 15 watchmakers to look at it. It's like, because there comes a point where, yeah, you've used technology for the analysis, you know where you're going, but the actual process of getting there is actually one that needs the interaction of a craftsperson and the physical object, and nothing else will do it. And that's I think what you described, which is so true for mechanical watches, that, you know, it's not a fashion object. It's not something we just chuck out for the value of its look and its Instagrammability. Actually, the learnings that go into constructing a piece like that properly, they carry the 153 years and industry-wide even longer, you know, many hundreds of years of watchmaking tradition on finding out what works and what doesn't work and what isn't beautiful. And maybe another example for our listeners that maybe not many people are aware of is dial finishing. You know, when you look at one of our blue or green dials, it looks easy. It's not, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we always see, like, no matter how sophisticated the coloring techniques are nowadays, there is still ultimately the person who's got the best craftspeople in the manual process will produce the best dial. There's no two ways about it. You can have computer-controlled ALD coating with hyper-precision. You can spec every minute color. But the depth of the dial and what makes the watch come to life on your wrist is actually because you have somebody who has 25, 30 years of experience of creating a handcrafted dial that makes a difference. And that's, I think, where that's really a fascinating part of that journey gives me the confidence that us humans are not completely redundant yet, which is
No, it's amazing. I mean, we have I teach in Vienna, and I have a research lab there that we're doing, in architecture and city planning and technology and so on. And I had a student last year who did a very, very deep dive into AI and machine learning, to the point where he was training a computer that he became very close to, which was very weird, that could actually produce, what he was doing was feeding the computer every important iconic piece of modern architecture that he could possibly get into the system, so that through a thing called GAN, through GAN programming and GAN software, that the computer would spit out the perfect modernist, let's say, building, right? This was the quest to see if the AI could drive something. And the lesson learned in that was that there's no better AI than the human mind, number one. Mm. And we have the ability to make mistakes. And that became a really profound sort of, let's say, epiphany. Mm. That what really makes the difference between machine-learned algorithms and the manufacture of something digitally and the production of something in terms of perfection is the fact that the human being brings to it the potential for error. And error, at the end of the day, if harnessed correctly...
It's evolution.
Yes, exactly. And can make something absolutely impeccable and beautiful and unique. And so it's this idea of a sort of, it's this fantastic oscillation between perfection and human error that has actually given us almost everything historically that we look to and say, wow, that is remarkably beautiful. That is remarkably elegant. These words that we throw around, beauty, elegance, perfection, have a lot residing in this. And back to that discussion earlier about informed intuition. You know, years and years of experience, and this is something that's, you know, I was talking to my son about this, who's 24, for that age group and for people kind of working in that moment, and I was like that too, I would imagine, one doesn't necessarily understand what years and years of experience brings to the table if everything is quantifiable and driven by the sort of, you know, the computer and, as you said, pressing buttons, producing 3D models and so on. No, it's in fact the opposite. It's the fact that all these layers of making these mistakes that you jump onto, then that mistake becomes the next thing you're doing, and then on and on and on, is evolution, as you said, and it's really amazing.
And some of the best things in life have been invented by accident. See the Swiss national dish of raclette, melted cheese, leaving the cheese too close to the fire, and boom, there we go.
there's more truth to that. You're absolutely right. All across the board, there are things that one wonders, how did we ever come up with this? It was a mistake. At some point in the history of the world, there was a little mistake made. Somebody rolled the boulder.
And it's very true, and it's one of those things, without sounding terribly old, that we have to really watch out for not to lose in this age where everything is measurable, quantifiable. There's a set of data for everything, and I'm often, you know, I fundamentally believe and agree that we can learn a lot from data, no question. You know,
yeah,
there's
absolutely
a lot of things we can learn, but I often try to remind people around me as well that, especially in things that are intuitive and emotional, and you know, sort of acquiring a luxury object often is one of those as well. You know, your behavior, I think, maybe I'm completely wrong with this, but it's not following a completely logical and sequential pattern.
Exactly.
Because maybe we all know that there are things in life that we would love to have. We may even have the means to acquire them. We like the brand, we like the product, we like everything. We've bumped into a couple of different shops and sales assistants. We left our contact details. They may have sent you a CRM email, etc. But for one reason or another, you've not bought something, or bought something else, or did something else. And you don't even, I don't often know myself, you know, rationally why that is. It's just, it's just what your intuition tells you to do at one point or not. And it's not what ad I've seen on Insta or anything like that. It's just sometimes things happen or they don't happen. And I don't think that this is like completely quantifiable and completely sort of, because it's emotion, it's impulsive. But
right,
we're already out of time. I was supposed to have asked you our standard questions that we ask all our guests. But actually, I think we've discussed questions that were equally, if not more interesting than just asking you about questions of time in your life. I could spend hours more time with you, you know, going down those little routes of discovery, because it's always super enriching and very, very interesting. Thank you so much for your time.
Same for me. Chris.
I'm still holding out for this opportunity to literally go to space with each other. You know what I mean? Which have to do. And I think we have a very nice.
No, I can't wait. I've got my spacesuit ready.
Yeah. And the cycling suit, by the way, it's on its way. The one that I still owe you. And I know that you have great ambitious plans on two wheels as well.
Do some cycling together. Okay.
Absolutely, will do. Thank you so much, honey. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Thanks to our listeners. And speak to you next time. Thank you very much. All the best.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. This is the Partners in Time podcast. Make sure you subscribe to never miss an episode. If you want to find out more, visit IWC.com. And you can, of course, follow us on Instagram. It's at IWC Watches. My Instagram is at Chris Granger Hare. Make sure you tune in. Speak to you soon.